Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is trumpeter and composer Walter White. White was brought up in a musical family in Detroit, Michigan, and settled on playing trumpet at age 9. He trained at several schools, including Juilliard and the University of Miami. White has worked with many of the top names in music, including the Woody Herman Orchestra, the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra, and the amazing Wynton Marsalis. In the 1990s, he toured with his boyhood hero, the late great Maynard Ferguson. Currently, White serves as lead trumpeter for Dave Matthews' Manhattan Jazz Orchestra. And welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Tish.
Now, according to your biography, you grew up in a musical family, and you were inspired at an early age by both Beethoven and Louis Armstrong. To tell us how you and why you settled on jazz.
Well, I don't know if I've ever completely settled on it, but early on, yeah, I was the youngest of 5 children, and both of my brothers played tuba, and my father played tuba, and my sister was in the band and played flute and bass clarinet and other instruments, and a lot of the high school band kids used to come over to the house. So right around the time that I was in 6th grade, I think, or maybe 3rd grade, I think it was, there was a talent show, and I think Herb Alpert was really popular at the time, Al Hurt. I started on tuba but quickly switched to trumpet. I think it was because one of my sister's friends from the band was playing one of Herb Alpert's tunes like Tijuana Taxi, and compared to the huge sousaphone that I had to sit in to play, the bright, shiny trumpet, you know, kind of caught my eye.
Yeah.
And that was right around the time that my mom decided to get me 2 different records, and this is where my kind of the dichotomy started between classical and jazz. She bought me a recording of the Berlin Philharmonic playing Beethoven's 5th Symphony and a recording of Louis Armstrong. So I would go to bed listening to Beethoven and the Berlin Philharmonic playing Beethoven's 5th Symphony. And, you know, during the day, listen to Louis Armstrong, and then I started playing along with the record. I didn't really know anything about what I was doing. I just knew that it was fun. So the years went by, and I kept a keen interest in both.
Yeah. I think it's amazing how Louis Armstrong has influenced so many generations, and it probably won't end.
No.
That's amazing. Well, what is it about the trumpet that you ended up finding so intriguing?
It's hard to say. I think also I had a natural embouchure for it, because I think when I was 5 years old, my brother was in the Boy Scouts, and he was the bugler, and somehow I ended up grabbing that and walking around the house playing it. And so my embouchure just naturally was geared for that. And I don't know, just something about the sound. And I also think that it was around that same time that I had a neighbor that played in the Detroit Symphony, and he took me to rehearsals when Doc Severinsen was rehearsing with the orchestra. So I think I was probably 8 or 9 when I first heard Doc and was able to stand underneath him and hear the power of the trumpet.
I often wonder why musicians and performers choose their method of communication, and the horn has been yours.
Yeah, well, and also, I mean, right around this very same time, 3rd, 4th grade, I mean, with all that I just mentioned, a schoolmate of mine, his father was a big jazz fan and used to take us to concerts that when Buddy Rich came through town. The first time that I heard of Maynard Ferguson was in 3rd grade, because we had an English teacher for a project. She said, go home and tomorrow bring in a record, and we're going to copy down the title of the record, and we're going to write down the numbers and the titles of the songs. And so I brought in like some John Philip Sousa record or something. My friend Randy brought in this Maynard Ferguson record, and I looked at it and I was like, whoa, what is this? And so afterwards we went to my house, because I live close to school, and listened to it. And that's when my life changed, when I first heard Maynard's sound. And, well, that was one of the key points anyway. I guess it wasn't the moment. But
yeah, but it sounds like it was a big moment. Tell us when you got into composing and then how that happened.
Oh, probably early on. I think we always had a piano in the house, and the concept of making up songs, I think I just got from childhood, my mom making up tunes and things like that, improvising. But it wasn't until, I guess, that I was in 8th or 9th grade, something like that, I started trying to arrange something for the pep band, one of Maynard's tunes, Gospel John. And I discovered I liked it. I liked to organize things. And then I had a little combo, jazz combo, when I was in 9th grade, and started writing little tunes for that.
That's so great. Oh, wow.
But, you know, I mean, then taking classes in high school and all that, I mean, I've never considered myself a serious, like, classical-type composer. I mean, although I do write things for symphony orchestra, but I, you know, the old axiom of composition being slowed down improvisation, I think, is still true, and as an improviser, we're composing things at the spur of the moment, and so I take that and expand that and slow it down. And over the years, and especially with the advent of all these great new software programs, it's really been great for me to grow as a composer and arranger, primarily.
Yeah, I'll bet. I'll bet that has helped with all this new high-tech world. Now, I do want to play a cut. This is called The Fox Hunt, and this is with Maynard Ferguson. Tell us a little bit about the piece.
It's a duet, actually, for two jazz trumpeters. And Maynard's nickname was The Fox way back when. And so there was many tunes. There was the Fox Hunt, Three Foxes, several other tunes that were written with that in it. So he started playing this, I think, back in the 70s, I think, when he had an English band. It's a composition by Michael Abeni based on the chord changes to Lady Be Good.
Okay, well, let's listen to it. That's got wonderful energy. I love this kind of music. Now, Maynard Ferguson died in 2006. How did that affect your life? Were you just pleased to have known him? And what did you learn from him?
How long do we have? No, I mean, he was an amazing spirit. And I learned, you know, above everything about the joy that he has when he's on stage and how to communicate that to an audience. And the trumpet was his first favorite toy, as it was mine.
Mm-hmm.
And not many people know that his first name is Walter, like mine.
Really?
But his uncle Walter was the black sheep of the family when he was a kid and was in prison or something, so they called him Maynard. So we used to joke around that it was the two Walters, the Fox Hunt. And so, in fact, when he first called me for the gig, I was in Toronto or something, and the phone rang, and I answered, and I said, hello, and I hear, who's this? He called me, right?
Uh-huh.
I could hear his voice. I recognized it. He said, oh, this is Walter White. Oh, yeah, Walter. It must be some Freudian thing, because, you know, that's my first name, too.
How weird that must have been.
And so we laughed, you know, and that's the first time I found that out. He actually showed me his license. It was true.
Wow. So there wasn't any real competition between you two? It was
just
great camaraderie.
No, as a band leader, I mean, there's no one that was better. I mean, the better that you played, the more excited he would get and the more energy that he would get from you and inspire him to play better, which would inspire you to play better.
Uh-huh.
And so it was, I've been in situations in bands where the exact opposite is true, where you're shut down. But in Maynard's case, he was just so, so generous that it was just unbelievable, his spirit on stage and off stage too. And just great, you know, and
wow, that's great. It seems like people with real talent admire other people who have real talent, you know what I mean? Instead of compete with them.
Well, it's nice to know there's others out there.
Yeah. Now you tour in Japan. You're actually quite well known in Japan. What is it like touring in Japan as opposed to working in the U.S.? Does the audience an entirely different, you know, feeling?
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like they're, I wouldn't say they're decades behind, but I mean their appreciation of jazz, it's almost like the people in the United States were about big band stuff and jazz stuff in the 50s and 60s and earlier. You know, they're very, very appreciative, and in the past we've gone there and you know, we do 3-week tours, and we go to these small towns in the middle of nowhere that have these municipally sponsored performing arts places that hold 2,000 people.
Wow.
And they're packed and in the middle of, you know, in the countryside.
Uh-huh.
Very appreciative and respectful and, you know, great fun. I love the Japanese people and the culture. So it's going to be interesting.
You're going back soon.
Yeah. You know. In fact, I think while this is airing, I'll be in Japan.
Uh-huh. That's going to be interesting to see how it's changed.
Yeah, I'll have to get back to you when I return.
I know. So many musicians in this town that I've talked to have connections in Japan. The culture seems to have such an appreciation for American jazz music and country music, you know, any kind of rock.
Yeah,
it's
true.
Amazing.
It's true. I mean, it's just, you know, a very deeply cultural society, and they put a great value on the arts and mm-hmm. In Europe as well. And that's why a lot of American artists do a lot of touring in Europe and Asia,
mm-hmm.
especially Japan, because of that. I mean,
yeah.
The appreciation factor.
Yeah. Well, I want to play another excerpt. This is called Amazing Grace, and it's with the Manhattan Jazz Orchestra. You want to tell us a little bit about it? It's an incredibly jazzy version of Amazing Grace.
Yeah, well, David Matthews, not to be confused with Dave Matthews, the pop guy, has been an arranger for many, many years and was musical director for James Brown for about 10 years.
Mm.
He's a New York arranger and has arranged for everybody from Simon and Garfunkel to David Sanborn to George Benson. In 1980, he started the Manhattan Jazz Quintet with Steve Gadd and George Young and Lou Soloff, a couple other guys. I think it was Eddie Gomez on bass. They had a gold record because it was a great record in 1980, and it was like the first time like a lot of American jazz artists started going over to Japan a lot.
Uh-huh.
So then the Manhattan Jazz Orchestra was an outgrowth of the quintet. And I've done the last 6 or 7 records with the band, I guess because of David's association with all the funk guys like James Brown and all that. The arrangements that he does aren't your typical big band jazz arrangements. There's a lot of funk infused into them, but still with the same instrumentation, although he uses 3 saxophones and 2 French horns instead of 5 saxophones, and we also have a tuba player in the band.
Wow, well, let's listen to an excerpt from this. This is Amazing Grace. If you're just joining us, my guest is trumpeter and composer Walter White. Now, I want to talk about the fact that you own your own studio. You also work as a producer. What kind of energy do you bring to the producer role?
What kind of energy?
Oh, uh-huh.
I don't know. I mean, it depends on each project. I mean, I'm involved in everything from writing string arrangements for Japanese pop tunes, to recording horn parts for rock and roll records, to doing compositions for brass ensembles.
Uh-huh.
So it depends. I try and bring as much creative new energy as I can to any project that I'm involved in. I just try and figure out what the core essence of the particular artist I'm working with is and let them find their way naturally. Uh-huh. But mostly what I've been doing lately is I do a lot of brass work, and I get sent tracks from various studios around the country. I still work with a studio in Detroit that does a lot of commercial spots. I did a bunch of brass tracks for a Walt Disney commercial. I played for a Shrek amusement park in China. I did all these, you know.
Do you find that stuff fun?
It's a lot of fun, and it pays. So being here in Ithaca, is wonderful, but it doesn't sometimes allow the work opportunities that a larger city allows. Because of broadband internet technology, it allows me to still work with studios in New York and in Detroit and wherever.
Yeah, and I know it's. I mean, this never changes. Musicians have to figure out how to make a living.
Yeah,
you can't usually do it as just a musician.
I tell young people all the time when I do clinics that gone are the days when you could just be one specific type of performer. You know, you have to be very diverse these days and know about computer technology. You have to know about all different styles of music.
You have to know how to sell yourself too, which
self-promotion
is surprising to a lot of people.
I've never been good at, and some people are. I was just having this conversation earlier with somebody about that the people that are really, really good at self-promotion sometimes don't necessarily need the amount of skill that you'd think,
I want to talk to you about this too. Does the music change, especially in regard to your own compositions, when you're performing in front of people? Does it feel like an entirely different composition when you have the energy of an audience
rather than in the studio?
For
sure. I mean, that's why I like live recordings sometimes. I like the control in the studio, but I'll never be completely a studio musician. I mean, I think that musicians that thrive on performance like I do, I mean, I need to play in front of people and to share the energy and to get it back, to continue living.
I understand that.
Definitely part of my being is the sharing of that energy. And I think people can really pick up on that, too, when a performer is putting that type of love energy, sound and love, it's all kind of the same thing to me, the musical vibrations and frequencies and all that.
Yeah, no, I understand that. Now, I want to play another excerpt. This is one of your original compositions. It's called Atlantic Bridge. Tell us a bit about it.
Oh, Atlantic Bridge is a group that was formed by my great friend from Ithaca, the legendary Steve Brown, who just retired a couple of years ago after teaching at Ithaca College for 40 years. Mm. When he was in Spain 20 years ago, he had a student, Alberto Conde, a young pianist. He got in touch with him a couple of years ago, and they decided to get this group together, and they wanted to have a trumpet player, and Steve asked me to do it, and I said, sure, it'd be great. And so four of the musicians are from Galicia, Spain: the saxophonist Roberto Somoza, the pianist Alberto Conde, the bassist Keen Garcia, and Miguel Cabana, the drummer, and then Steve Brown and I from Ithaca. And they came over and recorded here in Ithaca, and we mixed the record here, and it was released on a label in Madrid.
And then this is one of your original compositions.
And this is my tune, because as soon as Steve told me that I was on the gig, I said, "Oh, can I write a tune?" Because I always looking for a reason to write a new tune. Uh-huh. And I said, "Hey, has anybody taken the name Atlantic Bridge yet?" So I thought it would be cool to try and write something that incorporated a Galician melody along with more of a modern American jazz feel. So that's the origin of this tune, Atlantic Bridge.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of it. I love this kind of music. I'm a real fan of this. Now, you know what I want to ask you? A lot of people think about jazz and they think it's usually improv. But how much of it actually is? Any of it? I'm serious.
The improv part is all improvisation, I mean, it's all based on a structure, though. It's a blueprint. And, I mean, there's many different forms of jazz, but, I mean, a lot of times it's a song form, like the American song form. There's an A section that repeats, so it's A-A-B, as in bridge, and then the A section again.
Uh-huh.
And so that just keeps repeating and repeating and repeating. And so usually after the melody is stated, then that's where the improvisation starts. And the improviser is improvising over the chord changes. Just like in the Fox Hunt, that song was based on Lady Be Good, uh-huh. the same chord changes as that. And so the form stayed the same, but then the musician basically then starts improvising on the chord changes with a set series of scales that work over the particular chord changes.
Uh-huh. So it's not really improv. It does have a structure and a map.
It's got a structure. The thing that's improvised is the melodies that the improviser is playing. That's all completely improvised. Now, there is modern jazz that's completely all improvised, that there's nothing structured as well.
Uh-huh.
Ornette Coleman, Cecil Taylor. I mean, even then, that still has some structure to it. I mean, as human beings, I think we need to have some types of structure. So even in free jazz, people are laying out certain things that they may come back to later and developing a structure completely out of nowhere, you know. So I think that's it. But, you know, Phil Woods was improvising when he played the solo on that Billy Joel tune. And that was the first take. He came in, he saw the set of chord changes, and he just completely improvised over that.
Wow, that kind of stuff amazes me. And then it gets written in stone afterwards, right?
Well, then people can transcribe it, and then it's not improvised anymore. And then, you know, that's
exactly,
why.
Exactly, yeah.
When people transcribe solos, you know, when students when we transcribe solos to learn somebody's style, like if I wanted to transcribe some Dizzy Gillespie, I wouldn't write it down. I would do it by ear to get the feel of it.
Uh-huh.
I might write it down later just so that to have a note of it. Uh-huh. But it's the difference between learning something by paper or by ear.
Uh-huh.
And improvisation has a lot to do with listening and interacting with the other musicians.
Uh-huh.
So while there may be one soloist, the drummer and the piano player and bass player, they're still playing the same form, but they're also improvising based on what the soloist is playing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of that interchange that makes jazz interesting.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. I've often wondered about that. Now, before we run out of time, I want to play another excerpt. This is called Yo Conecto. Tell us a little bit about it.
That developed as a joke because we were in Spain and my Spanish wasn't so great at the time. And
neither is mine, you can tell.
Yeah, and I was trying to talk to somebody after a gig and I said, yo conecto, like mean I understand, I connect with you or
uh-huh,
something.
Uh-huh.
And Steve's wife, Barbara, laughed at me. She said, there's no word conecto, but I guess I found out later that there is. And so I got back, and when Jorge Cuevas asked me to play on his record, which we ended up doing right here at Rep Studios, he said, do you have any tunes that we could use? And I said, I've got a couple, but why don't you let me write one? So I wrote this salsa, and it became Yo Conecto, and it's the first tune on his record. So
that's great. Let's listen to a little bit of it. I love this Latin-flavored music. That's great, even if it's not a real word.
I think it is, because Jorge said it is. You know, he checked, and so it is. There is a verb conectar.
Were you trying to say comprende? I understand.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. I know, but no, I was really trying to say connect. I connect with you.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great tune, though. Now I want to ask you this, too. So you teach master classes. I know you do, and you do private tutoring. What beyond technical skills do you think people need to be really good horn players, you know, to become really great besides just the technical?
Oh, well, I mean, it's about having a depth of knowledge about all forms of music and being sensitive as an artist and being able to understand harmony and be able to play some keyboard and not just being a machine. It's great to have command of your instrument because that unlocks the door to being able to play what you hear. I think that any instrument should just be a vehicle. I mean, if I played bass kazoozophone, I would probably still sound like me. You know? So it's about finding your inner voice. It's about, you know, developing as a maturity as an artist and sensitivity. And a lot of times it starts by imitation, imitating people that you admire, and then branching out from there and not getting stuck in being, you know, an imitation.
Uh-huh.
After Charlie Parker came on the scene, there was a thousand guys that imitated him.
Yeah.
That's why Mingus wrote a tune called Gunslinging Bird, because he said if Charlie Parker was a gunslinger, there'd be a lot of dead copycats. Right.
That's great. So. Now, we are almost out of time. Do you still do the Ithaca Sound Maze?
Yeah, that's going to still be open, I think. And
tell us a little bit about it. It's fascinating to me.
Well, a friend of mine in Michigan, when I was visiting a few years ago, while he was out with his son getting firewood, noticed that two of the logs hit together and made a nice tone. So he started putting those together in his backyard and then started finding metal objects that made sounds. And the city of Cadillac, Michigan, commissioned him to build a structure downtown that won all kinds of awards and all that. And so I got back from Michigan and started experimenting with my own son, Jasper, just finding things around the farm that made noise. And I noticed one day that the raindrops falling off the roof, hitting these big 50-gallon plastic drums, were making nice sounds. So I made a drum wall out of a bunch of different plastic drums and found, you know, once we decided to put it inside the corn maze, there's corn mazes all over the place, but I don't think there's many that have sound installations within the corn maze.
That's a fascinating concept.
So once we decided to go for it, then I went around to the various local places. I went to Missouri Farms and found an old pile of broken harrow teeth, and I picked one up and I hit it. And I said to Jasper, "Eureka, you know, we found it." Because it was like this amazing pure tone that lasted for 20 seconds. And then so we went through the pile and found like 20 other teeth, and I made a rack for them. So it just kind of grew out of that idea. And then I was fortunate enough to get the Tompkins County Artist Grant last year. So I was able to put together a couple of new instruments, like the propane tank hand drums.
That is such a great concept.
Tuned in D minor.
Well, so I'm glad to hear that it's going to be open again. Walter White, we are almost out of time. Can you give your website?
It's walterwhite.com.
Okay, and so people can get in touch with you there, and they can get in touch with you about the Ithaca Sound Maze and some of your recordings.
Yes, and please also look on the website, because my quintet and my big band will be playing in town probably at least once a month. My band, Small, Medium, at Large, is the big band. And the Walter White Quintet, we've been playing at Delilah's and Oasis and down in Elmira and various other places. So
that's
keep
great.
An eye out for that. Thank you, Tish.
That's great. Thank you, Walter White. Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.